This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking to an Indiana author about a new book that she wrote about three women who lived in the American West from the Civil War through the Great Depression. We're joined now by Lisa Hendrickson, author of Burning the Breeze, Three Generations of Women in the American West. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, glad to be with you. Thank you.
Let's start with these three women that you've written about. How did you learn about their story?
Well, I've always been interested in the stories of women who did extraordinary things at a time when women weren't expected to. And I learned about Julia Bennett, who was the first independent woman to own and operate a dude ranch in Montana, and her mother and grandmother, from my brother, actually, who was living in Montana at the time. And he happened to be friends with Julia Bennett's granddaughter, who told my brother her story, and my brother mentioned it to me just as an aside, and I thought, that sounds like an amazing story. I really would like to learn more about it. And that started me on my own adventure of exploring their lives and learning about them and writing a book about them.
I definitely want to talk more about Julia and Lulu and Lizzie. We'll find out who they are a little bit later. But I want to know more about why you decided to tell this particular story. What was it that compelled you to write this?
I think they were all women who were adventurous, who were gutsy, who led lives that we don't hear about. When we hear about the history of the West, we hear about the adventures of men. We hear about cowboys. We've seen all those stories in movies and in books, and we haven't really heard too much about the women in these stories. And that's what really compelled me to look into their lives and learn about what they did.
That's a great point, because I think even myself, when I think about Westerns or anything about the West and those days historically, you just don't often think about women.
Right. And they obviously were there, and they contributed a huge amount to the history of the West. And they're just starting to be written about now. In my research, I found quite a few original documents that helped me tell their stories. And I just don't think many people are aware of what they contributed and what they went through. And in fact, most of the people who've read my book, the first thing they say to me is, I don't know how these women did it. Their lives were incredibly difficult, yet they managed to succeed and make their mark.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Just not only were they in such a tough lifestyle trying to go out into these rugged places, but also be mothers and raise children and do all of that.
Absolutely. And in many cases, raise children, in the cases of many of the women in this book, raise children on their own, either through divorce or their husbands being gone out on the range with the cattle. They really were the ones who had to pick up the pieces and carry the home life on from day to day. So when you think of the amount of work that they had to do and the fact that they didn't have many people to help them was stunning to me, the things that they managed to do and survive.
Absolutely. And can you give us a brief introduction to the women that this book focuses on?
Sure. The main character in the book, and I will say this is a completely true story. All of these women were real people, and all of the information that I present in the book is from original documents or newspaper articles or memoirs. So the story starts with Julia Bennett, who, as I mentioned, was the first woman to own and operate a dude ranch in Montana. In the late 1920s, she was separated from her husband. She'd been separated from him for a long time. She had two teenage children to raise, and she needed a way to make money. And because she had done some work on other ranches, she thought she could make a go of starting her own ranch. So she borrowed some money and found an abandoned ranch in the middle of a beautiful valley and decided that she was going to build her own dude ranch. The problem came when the Great Depression started after the stock market crashed. Her timing was terrible. And she felt that she had no choice, however, to try to make her dream a reality. And she knew that even in spite of the Great Depression, there were wealthy people out east who had this romantic idea of living out west and who might want to spend money to spend their summers out on a ranch in Montana, kind of living their idealized life of a western cowboy or cowgirl. So she, penniless at the time, took a train to New York City, knowing no one, having barely any contacts, and managed to, through her charm and her skill at marketing, attract customers to her dude ranch. So that's the start of the story. And then we learn about her mother and grandmother. Her grandmother, Lizzie Knave Martin, was living in Missouri in the 1860s, in the middle of the Civil War. Her husband died of consumption, and Lizzie was only 27 years old. Her young daughter was only 7. And another a thing that played into their decision to move out west was that Lizzie's father and brothers were Confederates. And at that time in Missouri, it was literally neighbor against neighbor, because Missouri was a slave state, but it had declared itself independent during the Civil War. And neighbors turned against neighbors. And Lizzie's family, according to family lore, had their land confiscated. So they all decided to head out west in a wagon train. It took them an entire year to get to the Montana Territory. And during that time, they encountered just unimaginable things. I mean, difficulty finding water, fear of being trampled to death by bison, storms, trying to cross raging rivers. They encountered death. They encountered hunger. And when they finally made it to Virginia City in the Montana Territory, where gold mining was going on, Lizzie had to make a life for herself, and she had to repay her husband's debts, because back then she was responsible for them, and the only way she had to make money was as a seamstress. So that's what she did with her young daughter, and she was literally traveled over throughout the West making money as a seamstress before she headed back to the Montana Territory. And then her daughter married a buffalo hunter and a cattle rancher. He was one of the first cattle ranchers in the Montana Territory. And together they raised 5 children, pretty much out in the middle of nowhere for a long time on their ranch. And that's the life that Julia Bennett, the dude ranch owner, was born into. And that's, I think, where she got the stamina and the knowledge and the guts to do what she did.
I want to go a little bit back to the Civil War period. In your book, you say there was a civil war within the Civil War in Missouri where Lulu and Lizzie Knave Martin lived. What was going on at the time?
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, Missouri had declared itself neutral in the Civil War, but it was a slave-owning state, which had come about through the Missouri Compromise. And one young Missouri woman wrote in a letter to her aunt at the time, "Many of the Southern families have left." Julia's brother, one of her brothers, was actually what they called a bushwhacker, a Confederate guerrilla. And so as there was not a lot of information available to me as to the exactly what happened to their family, but the family did say that their land was confiscated. I was interested to learn in my research that at that time, many Confederates moved out to the Western territories to either, in some cases, escape prosecution, or in some cases to just get away from what they called America at the time. The Western territories were considered, well, they were territories. And so when people got out there, they talked about America as a different place.
If you're listening and have any questions or comments on the topic, we're live right now. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Lisa Hendrickson, author of Burning the Breeze, Three Generations of Women in the American West. Lisa, when we look at these stories of people fleeing to the West, even though there were only new territories there and less resources or established communities, what was the primary reason there, aside from as you mentioned earlier, some of these historical things that were happening, was there anything that was seen as a promising new life out there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So mining, gold mining and silver mining, those were huge draws for many people, men especially at that time. And actually, Julia Bennett's father, Benjamin Franklin Benjamin Franklin Bembrick, went out to California during the gold rush in 1849 as a young man. So he had established a life as a buffalo hunter after the gold rush. And Lizzie Knave Martin's family, the men in the family went out west also to try their hand at mining. And actually, it was quite lucrative for them, and they actually did quite well.
And so when the Knave family left Missouri and headed to Montana, were there any challenges they faced on their journey? We're about to get to a break, but maybe we can pick up on this when we come back, just about some of the challenges on taking such a journey. I'm presuming it was a long journey back then before cars. So we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about a new book on three generations of women making a life in the American West during the Civil War and Great Depression. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All in. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking about a new book on the lives of Julia Bennett, Lulu, and Lizzie Knave Martin, three generations of women who made a life for themselves during a challenging time in the American West. We're joined by Lisa Hendrickson, author of Burning the Breeze. Lisa, before the break, we sort of touched upon what the challenges might have been like going from Missouri to Montana for these women. What was it like?
It was a year-long journey. It was very difficult. These women joined a wagon train of about 500 people that started in Kansas and headed out. They spent the winter in a place in Colorado called Empire City, and they ended up an entire year later in Virginia City, Montana Territory, which was where they had intended to end their journey. Along the way, they had to obviously take huge stores of food. They had to find their own, they had to find water in places where the water was often not potable. So they had to make sure that they carried enough water with them. Lizzie Knave Martin and her daughter had their own wagon that they covered with two layers of canvas on the top. And they even brought along a milk cow along with their oxen. One of the interesting stories I found when Lulu Martin wrote she presented to many years later to a group of women about her experiences on the wagon train. And she talked about how her mother put milk in a churn in the wagon. And as the wagon moved and traveled over the rutted roads, it actually churned the butter magically by itself. And so they ended up with what she called a most palatable spread. But they also had to deal with, there was a real concern about being trampled by herds of bison. And there were times along the way when They saw dust roiling up along the prairie. They didn't know what it was. They lived in fear of Indian attacks, which actually weren't as didn't occur as often as the newspapers of the time liked to talk about. But the bison, being trampled by bison was actually, I discovered, it was a real fear. And so when that happened, the travelers had to put their wagons in a circle, and all the people got in the center of where the wagons were. And as the hundreds or thousands of bison went by, fortunately, these wagons were spared. And afterwards, the men shot the bison, and everybody in the wagon train cut it up and actually used it as food. And Lizzie and Luli put it between the canvases in their covered wagon, and so it dried and made jerky as they traveled along. So when you hear about the ingenious ways that people had to survive as they traveled along, they also had to worry about storms out on the prairie. And in my book, there was disease. There were terrible accidents, and all along the way, these travelers found graves of people marked with wooden crosses. These tragedies even touched the Ney family as well, which I go into detail about in the book.
This is giving me some flashbacks of Oregon Trail that I played as yes. a kid, where yeah. you know, you learned about on the trail, all these things can happen. And a year is a long time to dedicate to something like that. Was there any indication why they didn't just stop somewhere halfway and just be like, this is where we're going to settle down, that's it? Or did they know they wanted to go to Montana?
Although I didn't find great detail about that, I believe that they were actually heading towards Virginia City, because Virginia City at the time was gold had just been discovered there. And I think the family thought that they could make a living in this new spot. But it is interesting. And they did overwinter in Empire City. And along the way, some members of the Ney family actually left and went back to Missouri because a family member, they had learned that a family member had become ill or died. So they didn't even all arrive in Virginia City at the same time. And as they traveled along, the wagon train became smaller and smaller. So many people, I think, did decide not to continue on, but the Ney family did. And when they got to Virginia City, it was a boomtown, a small boomtown. But then they had to spend a winter, a very difficult winter, because the snow was so high that it was difficult for the food to get to Virginia City. And there wasn't enough flour, and the Ney family had to sew bags of flour into their mattresses so it wouldn't be stolen, and hide it in the beams of the ceiling of their cabin. So they spent a very difficult winter there as well.
Wow. And to think that we think we have it hard these days.
Absolutely. We don't know.
You know, one thing I was curious about, you mentioned earlier, fear of attacks maybe from Native Americans. Is there mention of Native Americans at all in any of the documentation you found during this period of time?
Yes, it's interesting. But much of what I found was actually, you know, much like what you might find today in reading various things, there was a lot of fear and speculation about Indian attack. But according to the historians that I read, it really wasn't as much of a threat as most people believed. The real threats were disease. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was violence among Native Americans and the people moving west, because obviously the Native Americans' land was being threatened. And so they were defending their right to their land. But it wasn't from the research that I did, that wasn't the real threat. The real threat were things like disease and drowning and storms. But that wasn't what people talked about as much.
Yeah, it sounds like they had their own sort of version of misinformation going around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you read newspaper articles at the time, it's really quite stunning. The prejudice and the racism that was just, it was prevalent in newspapers at the time.
When you started working on this project, I'm always curious to learn just about like how things come together and how you find the material. Was it difficult to put this together, you know, to research stuff from the past and find stuff, or were you able to find relevant things?
You know, this book took me almost 10 years to write. I had no idea that it would take me so long. But I call it going down the rabbit hole. I just love doing the research. And I really wanted this book to give readers a sense of what it was like to live in that time and to put them in the scene. So when I was writing, I wanted to make sure that I had a lot of detail. And what details I couldn't find from the family, because there were some written records and letters from the family. I also did a lot of research in old newspapers and books. The interesting thing about my research is that I don't think I could have written a book like this 10 years ago, because during that time, most newspapers came online. And so I was able to search by people's names back all the way back to the 1840s and 50s and 60s and find a lot of detail. Another thing that was astounding to me was the helpfulness of people who worked in courts and courthouses and historical societies. For example, in my book, Lizzie Martin, when her husband dies, he left a will, and I happened to find the wording of his will online, believe it or not. And then I went on a search and actually called the courthouse in Missouri to try to find a copy of the will. And lo and behold, a person who worked there came across an entire file of Lizzie's debts and bills from the 1860s and how much she owed and how much she paid back. So when I talk in the book about how she went to a general store on a certain date and bought a number of yards of fabric, that is actually true information that came from these records. So I was astounded to find just all kinds of detail that I didn't know existed. And that's the fun part for me. The writing is hard. The research is fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so interesting. I'm just thinking now, like, I would love to just dig through old records from, you know, 100 or so years ago and just see what people were up to. I mean, I guess it also helps put things in perspective. But when you were talking earlier, you mentioned about paying off the debts that women had to do. And when Lizzie's husband died, she was not only caring for her child, she also had to pay off her husband's debts. What impact did that have on Lizzie?
Well, it was a huge impact. And one of the things, it took her 8 years to pay off those debts. And one of the things that I found interesting is that those debts were incurred in Missouri. And then she goes out to the Montana Territory. And you think about the fact that it may have been even difficult for those debtors to find her. But she was compelled, she felt compelled to pay back those debts. And so she did that by, she knew how to sew. She was a seamstress. One of the interesting things that I found was that she had the legal right to keep any of her personal property up to $200, meaning clothes, cooking implements, et cetera, et cetera. But she was required to pay back all of her husband's debts, including property that he had purchased before they were married. And I found a quote from one historian that I thought was very compelling. And he wrote that at the time, for many women, a husband's death brought his creditors down on the estate like vultures. And so their debts totaled $1,000 back then. And that equates to about $16,000 today. And it took her about 8 years to earn enough money to repay those, but she finally did.
Is it common, or what? I mean, was it common at that time for widows to take on their late husband's debts?
In Missouri, it was required by law. And then Julia Bennett, you know, years later, when she tried to start her ranch, women weren't even allowed to have their own checking accounts at that time. So when she had to borrow money, she had to borrow it from friends and family, local businessmen, and do handshake deals, which didn't always work out for her. So that's another area in which women we don't think about too much or are aware of. Just gaining access to money as a single woman was very difficult.
Was it hard for her to even get folks, you know, it sounds like she was going around trying to get some money, but were there any instances where because she was a woman, they were just like, no, I'm not going to lend you anything?
Well, Julia Bennett was quite a charming woman. I wish I had met her, but she was a master at getting publicity about her ranch in New York City. She had huge newspaper articles written about her. Her ranch was mentioned in the New Yorker magazine. And she went out there knowing no one. And the way that she managed to fund her ranch was to find these wealthy dudes, as they were called, Eastern dudes. She couldn't have survived without the help of men who lent her money. She had a dear friend who was a rancher who lent her money. She had even clients who visited the ranch who lent her money. So the fact of the matter is that she did require help from a lot of people. One thing we haven't talked about yet is that Julia, she started her dude ranch in Montana in 1931, but realizing that she couldn't make a go of it in the winter months with a Montana dude ranch, she started another ranch in Arizona for the winter months in Tucson in 1936. And that ranch was a property owned by the Westinghouse family, George Westinghouse, the inventor of fame. Their family owned a lot of properties, and they had actually come to stay at the Diamond J Ranch in Montana, and that's how Julia got to know them. She convinced George Westinghouse Jr. to lease her their ranch in Arizona, and that's how she got that business started.
That's really cool, actually, just thinking about all the different things she's doing.
Yeah, she actually, I love this story, she actually convinced George Westinghouse Jr. to lease her the ranch, but she actually didn't have money to pay the rent, but she became good friends with Mr. Westinghouse's wife, Violet. And so Violet Westinghouse and her kids came to stay and paid the bill. And that's how she paid back Mr. Westinghouse. So the women kind of collaborated on that project.
What was it that, I know we kind of touched on this, but I'm just curious, like, what was it that drove Julia to this kind of a business model? Was it that she saw this as a really sustainable way to live?
Well, I think so. I think going back to her own mother, her mother growing up on the ranch out in the middle of nowhere in the Montana Territory, people would frequently, who were traveling from place to place, stop at people's homes to spend the night. That was just kind of an expected way of, there were no hotels, obviously, in those places. So travelers would stop at ranches, and the ranches would give them a place to sleep and eat. So Julia grew up seeing her mother entertain people and take care of people this way. And she, Julia herself, had actually cooked on a couple of ranches for that were owned by a couple of wealthy Chicago brothers. So she understood this life. But she had also tried other professions. Once she separated from her husband, she had tried to be a stenographer at the Montana State Legislature, and she said she wasn't very good at it. She had actually gotten a job as a Fuller Brush salesperson at a time when they were advertising for men. They weren't even advertising for women to do that job. And she said they gave her the territory of Yellowstone National Park, which you can imagine there probably weren't too many people around there to buy brushes at the time. And she said, I couldn't make my salt at that. So I think she felt like she had no choice but to try this. She knew that she knew how to cook. She knew how to entertain people and take care of people. And I think she saw this as her salvation. And she loved doing it. She was a very optimistic person. She never got down, according to her granddaughter. So she saw this as an opportunity.
But we'll discuss this more after a quick break. We're talking with the author of a new book about three generations of women who lived in the American West. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're continuing our conversation with Lisa Hendrickson, author of Burning the Breeze, a new book about three generations of women living in the American West. Lisa, when it comes to running a dude ranch at that time period, what was it like? What were some of the challenges that a woman who's one of only a few, or maybe the first woman to do so, is facing?
Well, to start with, Julia actually had to build these cabins on the ranch that she bought with a loan from her sister, was an old abandoned ranch with just a two-story frame house. So she had to have cabins built, and she hired a bunch of out-of-work wranglers to come do that in the winter. Then she had to buy all of the furnishings for it. She had to, and she knew that her clients would be wealthy people who expected only the best. So her granddaughter told me that Julia used to say, no dime store stuff for me. She bought beautiful wood furniture from North Carolina. She bought china with the Diamond J logo on it from Chicago. She had Pendleton blankets. She knew that she needed to have the best. She had a chicken coop. She had a cow for milk. And then she would often buy all the things that she needed for her guests on credit, which sometimes got her into trouble. But it was a struggle. And obviously the main struggle was finding people to come stay there in the middle of the Great Depression. As I mentioned, she went to New York City not knowing a soul, having no money, limited herself to one meal a day because she didn't even have enough money to eat. And she brought brochures with her that she had created. She even managed to, and I don't know how she did this, but she managed to track down the cowboy who would become later the movie star and singer Tex Ritter, who was performing in Green Grow the Lilacs, a play on Broadway, as a cowboy. And she got him to come and sing at these little, what she called shows, that she put on in the room of a hotel for people to come and see what her ranch looked like. She also brought things like saddles and spurs and sagebrush, and managed to convince a railroad agent to put these things on display in the Northern Pacific Railroad office, where people would come in and buy tickets. And she said she would see people standing outside the window looking at the display and talking about it, and she would listen to what they had to say about it. And that's actually how she got the first guests to her ranch, from people who were standing outside looking at the window and decided that they just had to go stay there. So she was quite the marketer. She wore her Western duds when she went to New York City. She wore her cowboy hat and her cowskin cowhide vest and her fringe jacket, because she knew that that's what people wanted to see.
That's really fascinating. And the fact that she was coming up with all of these unique, different things. I wonder how many other ranches started to copy her style.
Well, interesting story. At one point, when she went, because she went to New York in the winter time for several years to attract guests, and at one point, the railroad station manager said to her, "I've taken your display out because other ranchers who are here to promote their ranches want their own displays, and I don't want to play favorites." And she said, "Well, fine, then I'll just take mine over to another bank." And it's funny because then she said about a week later, this railroad manager came and said, "It's your display that they want. You can put it back in the window." So she managed to get huge features about herself in the major New York newspapers. And she said one of them, she even got a marriage proposal from a man in China who had read about her.
Well, is the Diamond J Ranch still open today?
It is still there, and it's owned by the family that is still owned by the family that Julius sold the ranch to in the 1950s. I went and visited it when I was researching the book, and it still has some of the original furniture that she bought and some of the bear skins that she killed, or the bears from the bears that she killed. It has some of her original china. So it's in an idyllic spot, a beautiful place. And yes, it's still there.
So we can go and imagine what life was like back then. Or I'm guessing it's modernized though by now.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Look up Diamond J Ranch on Google and you'll find it.
You mentioned that it took you 10 years to put this book together. What was that like, taking this much time to sort of delve in and find all of these different pieces? Was it hard to narrow down what you wanted to keep in the book and what you didn't put in?
It was. And I was also working at the time, so I didn't spend 24 hours a day working on this book. But yes, it was. I had so much material, and just trying to keep it all organized and remember where I had found things was a task in itself. But I created a system for myself, and I did overwrite because there was so much information that I found was fascinating. And I would go back and read it and I would think, well, that was fascinating to me because I discovered it, but would the general reader be interested in this detail? Probably not. So putting it together and structuring it was hard work, but it was also fun to do all of this research and find out all of these things that I didn't know. I'm a Midwesterner. I really didn't know anything much about Western history until I started researching this book. And there were so many helpful people in little museums and archives throughout the West who helped me. I couldn't have done it without them.
How was the family's response when you were putting this together?
Well, I did work closely with Julia's granddaughter, Sherry Pepper, who was a delight to work with. And I went out and interviewed her extensively, and she provided me with amazing resources. For example, Lulu Martin's scrapbook or photo album from the 1860s and 70s with photos of all of the family members. And Julie Bennett herself had dictated a memoir that was never published. So I had access to that. I also had access to Julia's, all of her brochures that she had created, photos. She would have professional photographers take photos of the ranch that she used in publicity. So I had really, really rich resources. And I did, in my research, discover information that the family didn't know, just because, as I said, many of those materials just became available through the internet. So it was a journey for all of us as we worked on this project.
You included a lot of details and real life accounts from these women that the book, it just feels so immersive, and some might think it's a novel, for example, like a story. And I'm curious to know what value you think this kind of storytelling adds to a book like this versus just a straight up history book.
Sure. Well, I have to give credit to an author who I just think he's a wonderful historian, Eric Larson, who wrote Devil in the White City and The Splendid and the Vile, among other things. I've always loved the way he tells true stories of history, because I think so much of history that we might have read about in school might have been dry facts. And I think in order for us to truly understand what was happening at a time that we didn't live in, we need to immerse ourselves in it and really get a sense of what it was like to be living day by day. And so that's what I strived for in this book. I wanted the reader to feel like they were reading a fictional story, but with the understanding that it was all true and that it all happened.
In the book, you also included the stories of others who made similar journeys to Lizzie Lulu and Julia Petora Pinton Belknap and Mary Sheehan Ronan. Mm-hmm. How did you find their stories, and how does that tie into all of this?
Well, that came about in my research, and it really came about because as I was trying to learn about the lives of these three women, I realized there were a lot of gaps in what I didn't know about their lives. So I went on a search for women who were their contemporaries who did similar things, because I wanted to explain what it might have felt like for a 7-year-old girl who was traveling across the prairie. And so that's how I came upon Mary Sheehan Ronan, who was also a little girl who had left Montana and taken a wagon train across to Montana territory. And she had diary, or she had written a book. So I tried to incorporate that information to fill out areas where I didn't have enough information about the family.
If you're listening and have any questions or comments for our show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with author Lisa Hendrickson about her new book, Burning the Breeze, about three generations of women living in the American West. Lisa, it seems like there's often a romanticized, idea about the West. And with your book, it kind of dispels that a little bit. There's a lot of challenges and difficulties. Was that something that you yourself learned more about as you were researching this book? Did you have any sort of ideas ahead of time that were challenged at all or changed?
I guess I didn't realize just how challenging these lives were. And I didn't realize some of the circumstances that women specifically had to deal with. Because, as I mentioned, there isn't a lot of historical information about them. So I was, and as many readers have told me, they were stunned by the hardships that these women encountered and the fact that they managed to overcome them. I have a quote in the introduction of the book from a woman who I actually know who lives in Indianapolis, who grew up on a Montana ranch. And a comment that she made to me, which really kind of brought it all home, was she said, in Montana, when we were growing up, we didn't worry about what was ladylike. We just did what had to be done. And another thing that I discovered is that when homesteaders were out in the Montana territory just trying to live day by day, many of the marriages that they made were not for love. They were for convenience, because they needed another hand on the ranch. They needed to team up to actually just survive. And I found a quote from a Montana woman who said, I don't know any homestead women or men or women who married for love. They did it because they just needed to be together to survive. So that was interesting to me. Another thing that was interesting was that, for example, Lulu Martin, who was 15 years old when she married her husband, Benjamin Franklin Bembrick, who was in his 40s. And Ben Bembrick was the buffalo hunter who became the cattle rancher. And Ben Benbrook had a daughter with his first wife who, from my research, I believe his first wife had actually come from Indiana, and she had died after childbirth out in the middle of nowhere in the Montana Territory. And so he was left with an infant to raise. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any information about how he did that, but you think about a man alone living in a cabin with an infant, and then you think 2 years later he meets this 15-year-old girl who can help take care of her while he's out ranching cattle or out tending his cattle, and you get a sense of what life was like back then.
Yeah, 15. That's quite young.
Yeah, actually, though, in my research, it's quite young today, but it really wasn't quite young back then. Out on the prairie, there were a lot of women who married at a very young age.
And I would think that they became widows a lot earlier if her husband was in his 40s.
Yes, yes. Although so Ben Benbrook lived a long life. He lived into his 90s, astounding. Yeah, but... But yes, you know, Lizzie Martin became a widow at the age of 27. Her husband died of consumption. She did later remarry a man also from Missouri who she met in the Montana Territory. But yes, that was something as well that they had to contend with.
As we get ready to wrap up here, what would you say has been the most fulfilling thing for you about the process of writing this or just publishing this?
Persistence, learning that I had a lot of persistence. I really was surprised that this turned into a journey that was interesting and fascinating for me, and that it took so long to do. And the fact that I was able to tell the story of these women who aren't known, but who like many women out West, that I was able to share their story and make people aware of what they went through during this time. I think the more we can delve into women's history and share their stories, we'll all be the richer for it.
And I wonder too if you know, books like yours will help to bring women's history to the forefront and stories that we might not have otherwise known about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I hope so. There are lots of stories out there, as I've discovered, probably more stories than are possible to tell. But I'm working on another one right now. So,
oh, nice. Can you give us a sneak peek at what you're working on?
Sure. I'm just starting on it, but it's, this one is about, a woman who did remarkable things during World War II who nobody knows about. So there are all kinds of time periods in history where these stories, can be told and need to be told.
Well, thank you so much. Looking forward to that. And thank you for joining us. Lisa Hendrickson is the author of Burning the Breeze, 3 Generations of Women in the American West. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.